Friday, partly sunny, and 33. Here are the new numbers just in. It is 19 degrees, wind from the west-northwest at 9, wind chill stands at 7 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.
We're tackling a very difficult topic on today's morning show, but one that is very important to talk about. How can a parent cope with the death of one of their own children? Nisha Zenoff was a therapist and a grief counselor at the time that she herself suffered such a crushing loss with the death of her 18-year-old son, Victor. In the wake of that terrible sorrow, Nisha Zenoff not only examined the experience of her own loss, but also reached out to many other parents who had suffered similar losses, and over the course of many years constructed an extraordinary book that has just been published, titled The Unspeakable Loss, How Do You Live After a Child Dies? It's published by Da Capo Lifelong Books. I began my interview with Nisha Zenoff by asking her to explain the title, The Unspeakable Loss.
The unspeakable loss actually comes from a childhood memory of mine when I was 10 years old, growing up in Savannah, Georgia. And an aunt of mine, Aunt Lena, had a huge portrait over her fireplace. And I asked my mother who that good-looking man in the brown suit was looking down at me, and she said, "Shh, be quiet. Don't mention it. I'll tell you when we leave Aunt Lena's house." And as we left, my mother explained that that young man was Walter, who had died on his way back to the Army in World War II in 1943 when he was 19 years old. And Aunt Lena never spoke his name again, Greg. And not only that, when Aunt Lena's daughter had a baby and named the baby boy Walter after the uncle that had died, Aunt Lena could never even mention her grandson's name and called him Billy. And Walter is now 65 years old, and I actually interviewed him for my book and asked him what that was like, not to ever be able to have his grandmother call him by his real name, Walter. And he talked about how for three generations that grief, that unresolved, that unacknowledged grief was so painful for him. And he actually says he wishes his aunt, his grandmother, Aunt Lena, could have read this book.
Of course. You say at one point in the preface in describing this sad situation, the whole family felt the absence of Aunt Lena's son, expressed in a terrible silence and the unspoken reverberations of her grief. Walter's death in 1943 became the unspeakable loss in our family, creating a veil of secrecy, pain, and unresolved grief for three generations. It's such a sad story on so many levels. I wonder if in your work and in conversations, if you have a sense of whether or not this woman's response to this tragedy was fairly typical of that generation. I'm suspecting it's probably more typical than it would be now.
I think you're absolutely right. In those days, people didn't have the resources that we have now for support. And Aunt Lena, bless her heart, suffered alone. She'd go into her room for hours and close the door, and no one knew what she was doing. And even today, we have so many resources like the international non-denominational group called The Compassionate Friends. It's an organization whose whole purpose is to support families where the death of a child has been experienced. And there's other groups like Hospice has great support groups, and Bereaved Parents USA, and Open to Hope, which is online. So today we have many more resources, including therapists who are trained in grief to help people go through these traumas so no one has to suffer alone anymore.
Mm-hmm. I think when you describe this, and in the passage that I just read, I was struck by the words, terrible silence. The family felt that absence expressed in a terrible silence. A lot of times when we think about silence, we think of it as a rather sort of neutral thing, and once in a while even a wonderful thing, because sometimes silence is a welcome relief from the noise of the world and various sorts of unpleasantness around us. But these words remind us that silence can be a truly terrible, painful thing. Under many circumstances, and especially under these circumstances.
And some pain is just too painful to talk about, so people don't. And I wanted to also mention that the title, the unspeakable loss part of the title, comes from my own experience as well as other bereaved parents' experience of not wanting to mention their child's name, the child that died, because they don't want to bring up pain for their friends or family. If you're at a party, a birthday party or a celebration, and someone says, how many children do you have? The question always is, do I say two or do I say three? Or do I say I lost my only child? And so that's always a question. When do you bring up the fact that you've had a child die? Because the subject is so painful, particularly to people who don't have a child and don't know what to say. Mm. So people who have not experienced the death of a child often don't want to bring up the subject of the child that has died. And we bereaved people usually, not everyone, because nothing is right for everyone, but usually we are honored and thrilled to talk about our child's life, especially if it's his birthday or a holiday time and you want to bring in the child's memory to keep his memory alive. So actually it's part of my mission to pave the way to help others speak their child's name. And I'm saying child, it could be a 50-year-old or a 60-year-old. If your parents are alive, you're still someone's child or son or daughter. Hmm. So I'm very passionate about speaking our children's name because that's how we stay connected to our beloved child, and the memory of their life can be honored that way.
You quote a actually bereaved father in your book, whose son died of a brain tumor. He said, our child dies a second time when no one speaks their name. I think for those of us who have fallen into that trap, if we want to call it that, of erring on the side of silence, it's important to read those words and think about the way in which silence actually can can cause another kind of pain.
Exactly. And it's actually okay to ask. For instance, it's okay to say, I'm aware that it's Victor's birthday today. Is it okay that we talk about him? Is there something you'd like to share with me about his life? And you can take that feedback from the parent who's experienced the death of a child and go forward with that. And if the parent says, if the father says, nope, it's too painful, I don't want to talk about it, then that's great. You've got that information. And you follow their feedback. If somebody says, oh, my God, that's a great gift you're giving me. I would love to have you tell me anything you remember about my child. And it's just being honest, but getting rid of the fear that we're going to make a mistake. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Nisha Zenoff, who is the author of a remarkable new book called The Unspeakable Loss, How Do You Live After a Child Dies? Support, Guidance, and Wisdom from Others Who Have Been There. As we already mentioned, Nisha Zenoff has been there. She suffered the terrible sorrow of losing a child. In her case, her son, Victor, one of three children. Before we learn about the circumstances of Victor's death, tell us first about Victor apart from that. What Victor was like as a youngster growing up and as he grew into a fine young man.
Oh, I love that you're asking that, Greg. That actually brings tears to my eyes and makes my heart so happy. And I actually have a photograph of Victor here with me because whenever I do an interview, I look at his beautiful face and it gives me inspiration and I connect with his love. And Victor was gorgeous, of course. Every mother would think her child is gorgeous. And he was gorgeous. He had a loving, warm personality. He followed his own drummer. He loved handmade boots and he loved music. He loved the Grateful Dead music. And he adored people, older people, babies, animals. Everyone flocked to him. But he was also complicated. He had dyslexia. He struggled in school. And he took drugs in those days. I asked a girlfriend of his, I said, do you think Victor was selling drugs when his friends would come to the door of our home? And she laughed and she said, oh, Nisha, Victor wouldn't be selling drugs. He'd be giving them away. And I sort of laughed and I thought, well, yeah, that's Victor. He would have given them away because he was very heartful and thought he would be helping people. So the life and death of Victor is complicated like it is for most children. He wasn't a perfect angel, but when I think of him, the positive things about his life are the things that really stand out for me now. His love, his sincerity, his creativity, his big heart, and his big warm smile and huge delicious hug.
Mm. Yes, you said that one of the things you think about is his sort of big strapping body. He was a very active young man, loved soccer, loved hiking, and that in many respects, what you maybe at least at some points most acutely miss, in a sense, is his physical presence, at least as much, if not more, than you miss, in a sense, you know, the other things about him. And I appreciate that you say that because I think that's the kind of loss that, you know, for those of us on the outside looking in, might not ever even think of or imagine would be sort of part of the picture.
Yes, it is absolutely the physical presence that breaks my heart, the absence of his physical presence that breaks my heart, because there are no hugs. I can't see him growing and changing. And so that's what dies. The question is, what actually dies? And that's the part that I miss. The rest of his being, I don't know if we want to call it his soul or his spirit or his heartfulness or love, those qualities I can still feel so strongly. And in that way, I feel as connected with Victor even more so, especially with writing this book. He feels very present to me. Someone asked me recently, Nisha, do you believe in an afterlife? Like you're going to see Victor one day when you die. And I said, I'm not waiting for an afterlife. I feel his presence right now in my everyday life. Yes, I still miss terribly his physical presence, but his spirit, his love, his beauty, his kindness, I feel connected to those things every day of my life. And that's what helps me get through the death of Victor. Hmm.
You do such a great job. You do such a great job of explaining the circumstances under which he was killed and the experience of receiving that news. Explain to our listeners the trip that he took and what you know, which is actually not as much as you probably wish you knew, about what happened to him.
Okay. He wanted to go to Yosemite, and he loved the nature. He loved hiking. He even tried climbing. And he went to Yosemite with a young man, a young boy his age. It was a week before he was 18, someone he didn't know very well. And they were hiking on Lower Yosemite Falls, and the young man was kind of teasing Victor and saying, hurry up, let's get down, hurry up, hurry up. And Victor said, I'm tired, I can't go right now, and I need to rest. And the boy said, oh, come on, you can do it, Victor. And Victor said, okay, watch, I'll show you. And he started to run. And unfortunately, Greg, that's when he tripped on a vine in the past, and that's when he fell over the cliff. And granted, it was an absolute horror nightmare. And he died pretty quickly after he fell.
You tell us something that is quite remarkable, and it's also the kind of story that we do sometimes hear, and that is of something that occurred with you earlier that day and roughly about the time that Victor suffered this fatal accident. Do you mind sharing that with our listeners?
No, I'm very glad to share it because I know that I'm not alone in having these experiences. There are so many mothers and fathers and grandparents and siblings that have reported such similar things. So I'm just very glad you ask about it. My mother and I were out having lunch together, and at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I started to feel nauseous, and I went outside and to the curb and started dry heaving. And after that, I asked my mother, who was in her 70s at the time, if she would drive the car. I said, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I just feel like I'm dying. I'm sick. I even used the words, I feel like I'm dying. I'm sick. And so I let my mother drive the car back. And later that evening, I was home alone, and the doorbell rang. And it was a police. That doorbell ringing is what every parent hopes never, ever in their life to hear when they're alone and when they have their children out in the world. And the policeman asked if I was home alone, and I said, yes, why do you want to know? And he said, because we have some difficult news to tell you, and we're concerned if you're home alone. And I opened the door, and they said, do you have a son named Victor? And I said, yes, I do. Is he okay? And they shook their head. There were two policemen. And I said, is he okay? Is he okay? Is he alive? And that's when they shook their head. And they said, no, there's been a horrible accident. And, of course, I went into immediate shock. And what I said to them was, after I let out a horrible, blood-curdling scream, was, did the accident happen around 3 o'clock this afternoon? And they looked at each other, and then they looked at me and said, yes, it did. How did you know? And I just took a deep breath, and I said, I'm his mother. We have a way of knowing.
I have heard other stories like that, and it really gives one pause, doesn't it?
It does. We are so connected, Greg, in ways that we cannot even begin to understand, because our brains are limited in the understanding of these things that just are beyond our comprehension.
One of the things I mentioned in the introduction was the fact that you are a psychotherapist and a grief counselor, and in a sense, you came to this moment, in a sense, with some preparation that someone else in another line of work might not have. That being said, I think what you really end up conveying in the book is that, at least in the immediate moment, and understandably so, your professional preparedness had nothing to do with being prepared for news like this. In other words, in the moment that you received this news, you weren't a grief counselor with expertise in grief. You were a mother like any other mother, in a sense. Is that fair to say? Or did it make some difference even in that first terrible immediate moment?
It made absolutely no difference. Nothing that I had learned professionally or with all my experience being a grief counselor and therapist for years, nothing mattered. I was completely blown apart. My heart was shattered. I didn't recognize myself. You know, Greg, grief affects us emotionally, physically, spiritually, interpersonally. I was never prepared for what I experienced, the torturous, unpredictable grief that I was bursting with. And that's really when I said, I don't know if I can make it. I don't know how people make it. How do you live after a child dies?
We're speaking with Nisha Zenoff about her book, The Unspeakable Loss, How Do You Live After a Child Dies? A moment more with your story before we dig into what this book really does for the reader. And, of course, part of what the book does is share your own story, but many other stories are part of this book as well. One of the next steps was, of course, for this news to be shared, of course, with your husband, who was actually in Milwaukee at the time at some kind of reunion, but then also to share this news with your other two children, both of whom were out of town. In fact, one of them out of the country at the time. Can you just explain how difficult this part of the experience was? Even apart from the fact that they weren't actually with you and you had to figure out sort of logistics of sharing this news with them, what kinds of things did you and your husband think about in terms of how and under what circumstances exactly to share this news with them?
Well, your questions are so potent and right on, and the way you're asking them, actually, as I'm thinking back to that moment, I can feel some of the nauseousness that I felt then and the trembling in my body. So I just want to say, when we say Nisha has been there, I want to say Nisha is always there now as well, because even though I'm not, you know, crying nonstop or non-functional, those kinds of things have healed in my heart and in my body. The trauma is still there at a cellular level. And the question, how do you go about telling your husband that his son has just died? How do you go about telling a 15-year-old and a 13-year-old, who one at camp and one out of the country, that their beloved, precious older brother has just died in an accident? where do those words come from? Where does the guidance come from that gives us that information? How does one do it? It's more heartbreak to give that information, and no one knows how to do it, quote, right. And so you just blurt it out. You just do what you do. And I remember the policeman saying, we're going to stay here with you until you speak with your husband. And so they did. And then when we called to tell our son who was out of the country, he was actually in Israel. And he said, well, before I come home, Mom, I want to put a prayer in the Western Wall for Victor. And then we had a friend meet him and fly with him home. And then our daughter, Faye, was in camp, and we asked the camp director to not tell her. We wanted to tell her. And they drove her halfway, and we met her at a restaurant. And that's when she looked at us, and she said, oh, my God, what's wrong? You both look awful. You look like you've aged 30 years. And she was all of 12 and a half, I think, at the time. And then we told her that her special older brother had died. And then we drove back in the car just holding her together. And everyone goes into shock. So you really don't have control over what you're saying or how you're saying it. And there are many things that I wish we could have done differently at that time. But, of course, you do the best you can given the situation. You do the best you can. And in those days, I was praying for guidance.
Your book, The Unspeakable Loss, is laid out in a very intriguing fashion. That is, we are given here and there sort of passages out of your own story of the death of your son, Victor. But most of the book, then, is actually laid out in a series of questions. Questions that a grieving parent might very likely be asking themselves at some point in time. And many of these questions are very understandable questions that we could very easily think of ourselves. And some of them are more difficult or more complex questions that I for one had never ever thought about until I read them in your book. Can you explain how you came up with these questions? I didn't bother to count them, but there's many of them. I mean, the book is full of these questions. And how many of these questions are questions that you yourself pose to yourself?
Well, let me start with the most important question, which is the question that everyone asks, even people who have never had a child ask. And that's, how do you live after a child dies? So that's a question, when a child dies, that's one of the first questions a parent, a grandparent, a sibling will ask, was how do we live now? And some people have lost their only child or all their children. I was very blessed to have two surviving children at the time. The book is laid out in a particular format because of a question and answer format, like you mentioned. Because when people are grieving, acutely grieving, their brain has something we call grief brain. You feel like you can't read. You can't concentrate. Your brain is foggy. I remember looking at a stoplight and not remembering if red meant stop or go. So your brain isn't functioning. It's traumatic to everything in your body. And so people often don't want to have someone else's long, difficult, painful story on top of their own story. They just want to get to the information and the questions that they want to know the answers to. Now, I also don't want any listener to think that there's an answer that's right or wrong. because the answers to these questions, and there's almost 100 questions, are answers that come from other bereaved parents, siblings and grandparents, about their experience. And everyone will find their own way. There's no right way or wrong way to grieve. There's the way that you do it. And just like love itself, there's no one right way to love. There's no one right way to grieve. And there's no one path to grieving that works for everyone. So the questions actually came from a mother whose child had died just a week or two before she called me. And she had three questions. And the question was, Nisha, do I have to live for the rest of my life with this kind of pain? The second question was, what do I do when I want to die to be with my daughter? And the third question was, Nisha, are you happy? And when I answered those questions, I told her that actually the third question brought tears to my eyes, because in fact I could, after these many years, say that in fact I am happy. I can experience joy again, love again, happiness. It doesn't mean that I don't still cry or grieve. And when I got off the phone with her, I was called my editor, and I said, you know what, we have to redo the book completely. Greg, I had already been working on the book for 30 years, so this was a long journey. And I had put the book in storage for 15 of those years to let it cook while I still lived through this process so I could write about it. And I said, I don't think we need to do the book that I thought I was going to do. I think all we have to do is answer those three questions, and that can be the whole book. And so we started writing the questions and answers, and I kept coming up with questions that I had heard from other bereaved families. And then that's how the question and answer format came up. But it came up also because I wanted to have the reader be able to not read the book from cover to cover. In fact, this is a book I never wanted to write. This is a book I never hoped that anybody else would have to read. But when you have to read it and you need it, I wanted it to be a book that someone could pick up, look in the table of contents, look for an area or a question that related to their experience in the moment. So it could be someone who had just recently had the death of a child, or someone for 10 or 15 or 30 years earlier had experienced the death of a child. And I wanted them to be able to read the question that was relevant to their life experience in that moment. And the answers are really compilations of answers from all the grieving and bereaved people that I had worked with in my practice as a therapist, as well as the many, many people that I interviewed for the book.
One thing that you mention in the introduction to the book, that's where we first hear about these three questions that had been posed to you from this woman you call Cindy, whose six-year-old daughter had been killed in a car accident just a couple of weeks earlier than that. You go on in the introduction to kind of chronicle the assembling of this book, and you say your initial research involved interviewing 32 mothers, all of whom had experienced the sudden and unexpected death of a child. When I read that, my first reaction was, wait, what about the fathers? I mean, is there something particular about a mother's grief in this moment? And of course, a little later in that paragraph, you go on to say that in doing further work on this book, and that you actually spoke to all kinds of different parents. But you began with mothers. Could you just say a word about that? And if there is a particular grief that involves mothers that does not exactly involve fathers, and whether or not this book is designed more with mothers in mind, or really can any parent or grandparent for that matter receive comfort from this book? Is that what you intend?
That's such an important question. Thank you for asking it. I wanted to go to the experts at the time after Victor died. And who were the experts? The experts were other bereaved families that had experienced the death of a child. The reason I chose mothers at that point was because I was a mother. And I wanted to find out if there was a difference in grieving between mothers and fathers. And I wanted to know as much as I could about the sudden and unexpected death from a mother's perspective. So my first research was with the 36 mothers. And then many years later, when I went back and interviewed another 46 people, I definitely included fathers, grandparents, and siblings. And first of all, there needs to be a lot more research on the question that you're asking about, is there a difference? And, I mean, we could talk about, you know, the mother carries the baby for 9 months and she can feel bonded to the baby earlier than the father can. But, you know, then there are people who have adopted children who haven't carried them physically or biologically. And so it's a very complicated question. I have had fathers who experience grief more emotionally than the mother. And so I don't want to put a strict line on grief and how grief is different. But what I can say comfortably from the research is that in our culture, girls and women are expected and accepted more for their emotional experiences. And boys and men, we've heard it over and over again, are taught, don't cry, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, chin up. And so we see that also in grieving, that, but again, it's not 100% true, because again, I've seen fathers who are the nurturing parent more so than a mother, but just generally, it's the mother that is usually more emotional, and the fathers often work with their grief in different ways, such as doing projects, starting a foundation or starting a project that their child was interested in doing. And a father can, and again, this is stereotyping, which I don't like to do, but just generally, a father will have to go back to work if he is the breadwinner, if it's a traditional family in that sense, a conventional family. But parents, mothers, and fathers grieve, and their grief is different than each other. There's no one's grief that is like no other person's grief. And so we really can't talk about how one grief is not worse than the other, or one grief is not more intense than the other. It's about how you express the grief that is the difference.
One theme that emerges again and again through the course of many of these questions, although it's often phrased differently, is how does one cope with the sense of bitterness, or how can one accept something that is so terribly unfair? I mean, it's just not the way it's supposed to be. Of the many fundamental questions that are explored in this book, it seems to me that that is one of the most fundamental when it comes to this particular kind of loss.
Yes.
What are your thoughts for those who might be asking that kind of question of themselves right now?
In our group last week at the Compassionate Friends meeting, one mother was saying, I will never, ever get over my anger. And I don't know if I can live through this. And across the table was another wonderful bereaved mother, and she said, it's a decision one has to make. You can either be bitter or you can be better. And you can just change the I to the E, and it's a decision. And people were agreeing that it's a decision ultimately one has to make how you're going to live after your child dies. And the word that you use that I want to circle back to now that my brain is working a little bit better and I can remember what you said, the word accept. So we never have to, quote, accept the fact that our child died in the sense that we will ever like it. No, we will never like the fact that our child died. But what we do over time with work is accept the reality that our child has died, that the physical part, as we talked before, has died. But as far as accepting how unfair it is completely unfair, but then life is unfair. And we know that. And we know that we don't have control over things like nature. But we will never accept in terms of liking the fact that a child died, but you can accept the reality without liking it.
Hmm. You also pose questions in a couple of different ways that speak to parents who must continue to parent their surviving children. And, of course, you and your husband had two other children whom you had to continue to parent. And I suspect that that is a very, very difficult challenge indeed, even as you are dealing with your own grief, to not be so lost in your own grief as to lose sight of the grief which they also are experiencing and for which they also desperately need help.
That's one of the most important issues there is after one of the children dies in the family and if you're blessed to have other children. And I know it was years later when my beautiful daughter said to me, Mom, I felt your grief was the biggest grief in the room and that there was no room for my grief. Oh, my God. And my heart was just breaking because I knew she was right. Because in my grief that I felt engulfed by, I did feel my grief was the biggest in the room. And it was very hard, very difficult to find the energy and the positive attitude again to parent my children like they deserve to continue to be parented. And siblings are the most unacknowledged and most often ignored people in the room, because people will ask the children, how are your parents doing? And forget to say to a child, what's it like for you that your brother died? How are you doing? How are you doing at school? What are your activities now? And addressing the child with their feelings. And believe me, it's never too late to make an apology. And years later, when my children were in their 30s, 40s, 50s, they're at their early 50s right now, I apologized because, of course, I had to accept and have compassion for myself. I did the best I could, but I wasn't fully there to parent them the way I would have loved to parented them because of my own grief. Now, I can also say that today, when I see some parents who've had the experience of having one of their children die, I can say truthfully that these parents of today are so much wiser than we were. Maybe it's because they're seeing great grief therapists or going to support groups or reading some of the wonderful books out there on grieving. But some of these parents are so wise today, knowing how to work with their own painful, painful grief. And at the same time, maybe not being fully present as they would like to be, but still being amazingly there for their children who need them so desperately.
In our last couple of minutes, I think we should circle back to the point of the extent to which you now feel happy, that it is possible to feel happy again. And of course, for many parents in such a position, they feel a sense of guilt over allowing themselves to enjoy anything about life again, as though that is some sort of mark of disrespect for the child that they have lost. What would you say to such a parent who is, in a sense, reluctant to feel joy again?
Yes, some parents are reluctant to feel joy because they feel their pain is connecting them to their child, and that their pain is a sign of their love, and their love is a sign of their grief. And so they are reluctant to give up their mourning and their grieving. And what I often say, because this is what I've learned from other experts, from other families who've bereaved, and some of my own experience, is that we honor our child, the child who died. We honor his or her life by living our lives. And it's really with love that we get through this. When we can open our hearts to ourselves, to forgive ourselves for things that we didn't do the way we would want to, or guilt. When we can feel compassion for ourselves through love, it can help connect us to the child who's died, so we can feel love for the child who's died and not surround that love with pain, but true love for our friends, for our families, and then love for this amazing gift of life, that who better than someone who's had a child die know the preciousness of this life that is such a gift, and how quick and short it can be. That death, we cannot any longer live in a death-denying society and culture, we who have experienced the death of a child, because we know that death is a breath away. And so we are not separated from death. So we can feel the acceptance of this life and this preciousness of love. And truly, in my experience, it is love that gets us through. And like in a marriage and with couples, Bruce Feiler, an author and a friend whom I respect tremendously, said, it's a quote, it was in the New York Times, and I'd like to share it with you and the listeners. He said, love is bringing imaginativeness to the unimaginable. Love is bringing imaginativeness to the unimaginable. It's not a choice you make once, but over and over again.
On that inspiring note, we leave it to our listeners to explore your remarkable book, again called The Unspeakable Loss: How Do You Live After a Child Dies? Published by Dacapo Lifelong, the author, Nisha Zanoff. Nisha Zanoff, thank you so much for creating this powerful book that I know will be of great, great help to many, many people. And thank you for being part of The Morning Show. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Greg, for having me on. It's been a pleasure, and I so appreciate your questions. May I invite your listeners to go to my website, TheUnspeakableLoss.com, for more information. I thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And tomorrow on this morning show, we will pursue this important topic further by speaking with Debbie Rambis. Debbie Rambis is Executive Director of The Compassionate Friends. This organization has more than 600 chapters across the country in all 50 states, plus Puerto Rico, Guam, and Washington, D.C. And Compassionate Friends reaches out and offers support of all kinds to parents who have suffered through this exceptionally difficult sorrow, the loss of a child. So please tune in tomorrow for that conversation with Debbie Rambis from The Compassionate Friends. Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgift.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.